Greetings and good evening, everyone, and welcome back to the Mark Fraley Podcast. Today is February 8th, 2018. What started out as a frosty morning turned into a beautiful sunny day here in Nashville, with temperatures reaching up into the 40s. Spring is hopefully just around the corner. And could there be a better time than now to talk about gardening? This is the time of the year that we are flooded with seed catalogs. Those of us that garden spend lots of time planning for the upcoming season. Gardening for me continues to be a learning experience. When I first began in gardening, finding the most unusual and most exotic plants seemed to be my idea of having fun in the garden. These days, growing and maintaining plants which make a contribution to the natural environment, that is, gardening with and for nature, has become the focus. And so today I have as my guest my friend Gail Eichelberger. Gail is the host of a garden blog called Clay and Limestone. This blog is just today celebrating its 10th anniversary. Gail's blog presents beautifully photographed pictures of native plants with eloquently written commentary on her experiences in gardening. Gail is truly one of Tennessee's experts on gardening with native plants. So please enjoy my interview with Gail and be sure to check out her blog that is at Clay and Limestone. Gail Eichelberger, welcome to the Mark Fraley Podcast.
Thank you, Mark, for inviting me.
It's really great to have you. I've been doing this a year now.
A year,
and have done a dozen or so podcasts, but you were one of the very first people I thought about.
Well, thank you. I'm highly complimented.
Glad that we finally got together. Gail, you and I have known each other probably 10 years or more, just through mutual friends and that sort of thing. And then I discovered we had a mutual interest in native plants and the outdoors and all that stuff.
Yeah, mutual, yes, deep.
Deeply mutual. Exactly.
For me, it's a passion, wildflowers and native plants. I feel very passionately about them.
To my listeners, right at the outset, I want to encourage you to check out Gail's blog, which is called Clay and Limestone.
Yes.
And it's a pictorial as well as written.
I would say it's blog. A photo-driven blog.
Exactly. Beautiful photographs. And if you'll just Google clay and limestone, it will come up. You will see it. And you are now in your 10th year.
Today is my 10th anniversary of blogging. I can't believe I've been blogging for 10 years. Mm-hmm. I can't believe I've had that much to say for 10 years.
Your blog is very literate, and for those that are new to the subject matter, welcoming. So it's
thank you. Yeah, so that is the kind of feedback a blogger wants to hear.
Well, I want to encourage my listeners to check that out because it's truly an informative thing. Gail, how did you get into this?
You mean blogging or
well,
get into
your interest
plants?
In native plants?
Oh, wow. Well, I started with a lot of failure. I mean, I moved into this piece of property that is in the middle of the Hillwood neighborhood in Nashville. And it is the part of the Hillwood that the soil is very shallow, and the limestone bedrock that's a part of our natural history here, geological history, is very close to the surface.
Right.
And when I started, my dreams of having a garden were like a lot of people's dreams. I was going to have a cottage garden. I was going to have a Mediterranean garden. I was going to have all kinds of gardens that I couldn't have. And everything I planted died. And I just was really frustrated. And I started looking around and I realized that off into, on the sides of the yard were these little woodland remnants. And there were native flowers growing in there. And it was like a light bulb went, and something just went, Gail, how could you have missed this? And I realized that these were native plants and that they were thriving and they were happy. And so I just set about trying to find out as much as I could. And I was very lucky to find some people that helped me.
Okay, now who were those people?
Well, the very first person who helped me was Paul Moore from Moore Moore Garden
Center. Sure, absolutely.
Now, Paul doesn't own the Garden Center anymore, but right. he's very active in you know, promoting native plants.
Right.
And he had, at that time, he was the only place in town where you could find native plants and wildflowers. And I tried a lot of them, and some of them failed.
Right.
And that's when I realized that just because it's a native and from Tennessee doesn't mean it's going to grow and thrive in your garden.
Well, let's unpack all that just a little bit. What do you mean by native?
What I mean by native is something that's been here for hundreds of years, that grows naturally and is thriving in the conditions here, and that's formed a mutual kind of relationship with a wildlife that is also living around here. And so there are lots of plants that are absolutely wonderful that were brought over by the pioneers
right.
that aren't native.
Right.
They're beautiful, but they aren't native.
Right.
And so I wanted plants that had been here all along before pioneers had moved here.
They're adapted to the
conditions. They're adapted to the conditions. They can take what our summers are like and our winters are like, and you know
what our soil types are like.
And our soil type
right.
is like. And that's something that's really important. I really wanted to have some plants that I can't grow because my soil is actually what they call nearly neutral. It is neither sweet nor sour,
okay.
So it's not acidic or limey. It's just
right.
kind of in the middle. But it cannot support some of the native plants from like East Tennessee, which are used to acid soils.
Right, so your rhododendrons and those
rhododendrons that
plants.
I love, like
yeah.
yours, Mark. I love
yeah.
your native.
I have the native azaleas. I'm lucky to have deeper soils here and,
yes.
and different type of soil.
I don't know what your soils are like, but in my yard, they're anywhere from 3 to 8 inches. That's not much soil.
No. Yeah, mine are much deeper and they're richer. We live in an area where that had been used as a farm for many years before it was developed. And I think our house, or adjacent to our house, was the barn. So we have black, deep soil here.
Yeah.
So so what are the benefits of doing native plants?
The benefits of doing native plants? Well, first of all, they're survive in my garden.
Okay, all right. They actually
so
work.
They're
yeah.
maintenance free
yeah.
in some ways, although
yeah.
there's no such thing as a maintenance-free garden. But they're easy to maintain.
Right.
They can take the extremes weather that we have. And people from the north laugh when I say extreme weather. But usually their plants are covered with 2 to 4 or 5, 6 inches of snow in the winter when ours aren't.
Right.
So our plants are surviving cold weather. And so that adaptivity
raw
is really important.
Yeah.
Raw cold.
Yeah.
So that adaptivity. Also, our very dry summers, they're adapted to that.
Right.
And the other thing is that, I guess really adaptability is the thing. And their connection to the wildlife that's here.
You know, Gail, you and I have both been influenced by a guy by the name of Doug Tallamy.
Yes.
Who wrote a terrific book called Bringing Nature Home. And I encourage my listeners to check that book out. And he's got other books out. But for me, the connection that he made between the birds, the bugs, and the native plants.
I know. He has one essay about it's the bird that's right at your feeder right now, the chickadee.
Yeah.
And he talked about how many insects a chickadee needed to take to its nestling. And I was astonished. Thousands of them.
Right.
Thousands of them. And when and if you have plants in your garden that don't attract caterpillars, that don't attract insects that actually thrive on them, then if you don't have insects, you're not going to have birds
exactly.
in your garden.
You can feed the birds with, as we're doing here in the wintertime, with bird seed.
Well, you can supplement, but they really, that's just a supplement. Most of our beautiful songbirds need insects.
Especially when they're raising young.
Right, especially when they're raising young. And the thing that Doug opened my eyes to was how important trees and shrubs were. Far more important than my beautiful wildflowers that I'm crazy in love with. So what became really important was considering the canopy. And the canopy is the tallest trees in the forest or in a garden. So those tall trees like oaks and hickories and shagbark hickories and hackberries and elms and all those trees and ashes are really important because they support insect life.
They're feeding
hundreds and hundreds of insects. And when people get upset when they see some kind of gall on their leaf and they want to spray it, it's like, please don't, because those are the food for migrating birds and birds that live in your garden.
Exactly. The let's talk about that canopy. Are you planting new trees in your yard, or are you just living with the ones that were there when you...
I'm living with the ones and maintaining the ones that I have. I have an acre, and at this point I don't really need... I have dozens of trees in my yard, so I don't need to add more. But if I were going to add more, I would always go with an oak, because oak is the most... I mean, it's the tree that has the most... I'm blanking on the word right now, but...
No, it's got a lot of punch. It's got the mast. The acorns are feeding the
well, deer feed on it, and rodents feed on it, but right. Also it has the most insects,
right,
and moths,
right,
and butterflies and that live in those trees.
Okay.
And so it's really important. And not only are they really important, every one of those leaves that falls in the autumn is important. And so I rake them up and put them in piles and leave them in a pile to disintegrate. But that also allows any of the insects that are still in there
to overwinter.
To overwinter.
Exactly.
And so I'm not mulching them. I mean, if you want to mulch them, that's your decision. It's your garden. But I try not to.
You know, we move the leaves off of our lawn space, mm-hmm, which we've tried to reduce over the years,
yeah,
which is another subject that we can get into. We rake them into our beds. And I wouldn't necessarily call ours flower beds, because they have grasses and they have small shrubs and all kinds of things of that nature there as well. But they stay there. They don't ever go away.
Yeah, that's what I do too.
And I
call that relocating the leaves.
It's right, and it's mulch, and it's
well, it's what happens naturally in
exactly
a forest.
So my theory with our small wild garden is to emulate the forest floor, as forest as it would
right
occur.
Well, you're building up the humus layer, and
right,
that's really, and that is how I've actually improved my very shallow soil.
Okay.
And so, I mean, I have looked at it, and you know, and I'll pull it away, and I'll look at it, and I think, oh my gosh, it's crumbly. And it wasn't crumbly, it was like concrete. I mean, it still gets very dry, and much like clay would do it when it dries in the summer, but it really has improved
right
the health of my soil.
Right. So where else do you go when you're in need of inspiration and resources in your forward moving in your gardening?
Well, I often just head to the park. I just to relax and get inspiration. I mean, that's where I get a lot of my ideas for garden blogging. And the other day I was walking through, I went to Radnor and I did the hills, and I noticed all the tree litter that was down, and I just thought, oh my gosh, I need to talk about this on my blog, because these are really important parts of a garden, is to have snags, which are dead trees that you leave standing, if you can, and they're not dangerous,
right,
to let the limbs fall, because that's where the detritus of, I mean, mushrooms and other fungi just, you know, live on those, on that, and beetles live in there, and mice scurry through there, and chipmunks live in there, and it's really exciting, you know, it's a very important part of the forest. So I'll go there for inspiration. I also... am involved with a group that's of garden bloggers. So I'm always talking with them, and I go to a conference every year with them. And now they don't focus on native plants, but more and more we're seeing gardens that are all about natives, or mostly about natives, or a lot about natives.
There are some really, really beautiful gardens that are native plant gardens.
Really are.
The one that's coming to mind is the one in Chicago. There. The Lurie Garden.
Oh my gosh! Yeah. Well, that's mostly native, but there's a lot of plants that aren't native. Yeah. But what they have is a lot of wildlife value, high wildlife value. Mm-hmm. So you'll see catmints and mint plants that bees like, and even our native bees are attracted to them, and for the pollen and the nectar. So it's
Tell us about your concern and your interest in pollinators. I know that's something.
I just fell in love with pollinators. I think they were probably, I don't know what happened first. Did I fall in love with pollinators or did I fall in love with wildflowers? But I was in my garden and it was in the fall. And that's when I see most of the pollinators in my garden, because that's when what I call the ex-asters, they've changed their name from aster to
ex-aster.
Yeah, so I call them ex-asters. But that's when all of the woodland asters are blooming, and I would...
In the fall.
And so I was in the garden, and I heard this buzzing, and I just saw these bumblebees madly working these plants, and I just wanted to know more about them. And that when I started researching bumblebees, that's when I discovered that people were very concerned about what was happening with honeybees. And honeybees are really sexy because they make honey, and you know, we want honey and it's tasty. They're not native to North America, and they took away a lot of attention from our native bees, which are in decline because of loss of habitat.
Right.
And that's probably...
And from toxins.
And from toxins, yeah. And especially plants that are pre-treated by neonicotinoids.
All right, let's...
Well, there's so much we could talk about bees.
Yeah, let's talk about... So if you go to a garden center and buy a plant, native or not native, that's a flowering plant.
You don't know, unless they tell you whether or not it's been pre-treated with a plant, a systemic, that's what a neonicotinoid is. It's a systemic plant that is taken off up with sprayed, and it's taken into the very being of a plant and comes out in its pollen and nectar, so that pollinators, when visiting these plants, are taking back the nectar and pollen to their nests, and it's
and
there.
The insecticide
and
as well.
The insecticide is there, and it's affecting them.
How do we avoid that?
Well, I shop at a local native nursery that I know doesn't pre-treat their plants. Okay. And if I order off the internet, I order from nurseries I know that don't pre-treat.
Okay. We're not ashamed to name names here.
Well, I shop from Grow Wild, which is out in Fairview.
Right.
And they're open 2 times a year for big sales, but also whenever you make an appointment with them, and Terry or Mike can fit you in.
Right.
And it's just a delight to go out there. And I order, even though I like to order locally my plants because I think they have a better chance of surviving, I will order from places like Prairie Moon Garden. Mm-hmm. The problem with ordering plants that come from upper Midwest is they're breaking dormancy when we're moving into summer.
So
you can order these plants and then have them shipped when they go dormant. And the dormancy for them is when it's perfect time to plant for us in the fall.
Okay.
So I order from Prairie Moon Nursery and places like that.
I've ordered. I've had good luck with a outfit called Izel.
Oh yeah,
Nursery.
They make beautiful shrubs.
And they will sell you what they call a liner pack, I guess is what they refer to it as, where you might get 50 of the little blue stems, and you get them very, very inexpensive. If you were to buy them potted out,
it's a good way for people to go together and buy some plants.
Exactly. Well, it's those are two sources, but I think it's a good point to make, to be thoughtful about where you purchase, because You don't want to be putting something in your garden that's actually going to be harmful to the insects. And
Well, I don't shop at most big box stores because I can't be sure. Right. And I have heard, and I hesitate to say because I'm not really certain, but I have heard that some of the independent garden centers have relationships with growers who say they don't pre-treat.
Right.
So I ask them. For instance, if I go out to More and More, I'm going to ask, you know, do you know where, do you the provenance, I would say, almost in kind of this plant, and I would ask.
Right. Now, some of the plants at More and More I've seen, they'll actually have a tag from the nursery.
Yeah.
So you can see it was done at whichever nursery it was.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So this is an interesting topic for sort of plant people. So you have a native plant.
Right.
Let's say the echinacea, the purple coneflower. All right. Now you have that plant as it occurs in nature, the straight species.
I have a straight species, which means that it hasn't been bred to have specific characteristics.
Right.
The life has, I always think of it as the life hasn't been bred out of it. The petals are where they're supposed to be. The petals are shaped the way they're supposed to be.
Right.
The pollen is there. They're not sterile. A lot of times you go into a nursery and there is this beautiful puff of a plant that says it's a coneflower. But when you really look at it, you can't find anything that a bee can utilize because it's a sterile plant.
Okay.
So that means it doesn't produce seeds, but it also means it doesn't usually produce the things that attract pollinators so they can create seeds. So there's no pollen and there's no nectar.
Okay, so a plant that's been improved, let's say, with quotes around the word improved, by hybridization. Now, we're not talking about genetic manipulation or anything of that nature, but just hybridization. We would call a cultivar.
Yes, although some cultivars, things that are called cultivars, are natural selections. And so what they are is that they just sort of naturally occurred. And then when you look at those, and if
I we've picked those out and said, hey, that's a nice one.
Right, and so maybe they've done cuttings of them, and so they're produced not.
So it's a variant.
Right, it's a variant.
Yeah.
So what I do if I'm someplace and I know they're not poisoned plants,
right,
I'm going to watch and see if there are bees on them.
Okay.
I'm going to watch and see what kind of bees are on them. I'm going to watch and see if there's, if first of all, I want to know this nursery actually has critters visiting it.
Right.
So I want to see bees. I want to see carpenter bees. I want to see little tiny sweat bees. Those are the little tiny green ones. I want to see bumblebees and I want to see honeybees. And I want to see any butterflies that are hanging around there. That lets me know that this plant is offering something.
Right.
And sitting next to it can be an absolutely stunning plant. Not one visitor. And so I'm going to, you know, make sure I choose a plant that's, you know.
It occurs to me to ask you about bees. And I've been gardening 30 or 40 years, longer than that probably, if I can include the time I spent with my mother in the garden as a child. I've been stung by a bee maybe once or twice, and that's all. I mean, it's a rare thing to
have
happen. I have
never been stung by a bee. I pick them up.
Yeah.
Hold them in my hand.
Yeah.
I've got photos of that.
Right.
The only time bees get aggressive is you're near their nest.
Right.
And have you been buzzed by a carpenter bee?
Sure. Oh,
well,
yeah.
They have no ability to sting you. They're just all buzz.
Right.
I mean, that's all they do. They just sort of buzz at you. The thing that I stay away from are yellow jackets. Now, that's a whole nother
kind of
thing.
Yeah, my sweet wife got into a swarm of those.
They're scary.
That had made a nest in our garden, had in a hollow in the ground, a tunnel down in. And she was weeding out there one day, and she came running to the house, you know, 20 yards away, removing her clothes as she was.
I understand completely.
And we had, you know, this is a rare thing for us to hire an exterminator, but we we couldn't go in the yard because the...
We had to do the same thing, Mark, and I hired some guy who didn't seem to care. He was out there digging. He didn't care if they were swat matting or anything.
Right.
But he dug the nest up.
Right.
I have read since then that if you can approach the nest at night when they're quiet, you're going to laugh at this, pour some honey into it.
Oh, boy.
Seriously, you could attract... Are you ready for this? Skunks. Skunks don't care at all about being stung, and they will come and dig it up. And I haven't tried that because I haven't found a quiet time when you can get near one of their nests, but I thought that was really fascinating.
I'll tell you, I haven't seen a skunk in our neighborhood.
I have smelled them.
Yeah, in a good long time.
Yeah.
So, design in a garden is a whole another topic, isn't it?
It really is, and I wish I were truly... I mean, I know when I walk in a garden if it feels right, but sometimes in my own garden, I have a very difficult time editing out the babies that are growing.
Okay. You know?
So I have a tendency to garden the way I would say that Doug and in his book, The Living Landscape, talks about. I garden... There's not a lot of space in my garden for mulch and weeds to pop up because it's filled with a lot of dense plantings.
This is a real important tip that you're giving us here.
Yeah.
And let's draw this out just a little bit. I think there's the kind of garden that you see, and I think our friend Mike Berkeley in his show garden at his...
Right, and he's showing off. He wants you to see that plant.
Right.
So he'll have a plant with some space. A plant with some space.
Exactly.
But I don't garden that way.
And, you know, I would love to have a garden that looked that fine. I mean, it's just beautiful to see.
He has a crew.
Yeah, well, he has a crew to maintain it. Maintaining that kind of a garden is work.
It's a lot of work.
Yeah.
It's a lot of work.
So the thing I like... And there's a book called Planting in a Post-Wild World. I've got it here. And
that's actually the style that they talk about.
That's exactly right. Using plants as mulch.
As mulch, yeah.
So you may have a species or specimen plant that you're really proud of, but you're going to have a lot of other smaller plants around it and fill it in. And if you go out in nature... That's what you see.
It's exactly what you see. It's exactly what you see. And it's beautiful. Yeah. And, you know, and when you think about the way that gardens aren't really natural constructs, they're what we construct. And so it's...
Gardens don't occur in nature.
Right. In fact, I was quite shocked when I went to a woodland and I was thinking, where is everything? Because it's dark and there are a lot of these plants don't survive without sunshine.
Right.
But yes, I plant very intensely and I let plants fill in and I call those my rough and tumble wildflowers. And those are plants that are really good at colonizing. And
give some examples.
Well, most of the asters, the New World asters, are really good colonizers.
They seed, or they come
seed,
up
or they
from
or they spread roots. Vegetatively
okay.
by their roots.
Okay.
Goldenrod, which can be a thug, you know, you have to pull it judiciously.
Okay.
Some of the black-eyed Susans can spread very aggressively. There are grasses that are rough and tumble wildflower types. A plant that I adore but a lot of people have trouble with is called obedient plant.
Mm-hmm.
And they just think it's unruly. And I think that there are folks who don't mind, I don't mind a swath of this beautiful pink obedient plant that I see bumblebees just have adding at it.
Right.
But I can move that stuff around and I can create a space. This past fall I planted a sumac. And I was, I planted a sumac. I know I'm brave to plant a sumac in my garden because they are colonizers.
Right.
In fact, a lot of native plants are colonizers.
Right.
And that's just the way it is.
I mean, that's natural succession.
Right. It's colonial. That's what they do. They create. Right. They create an area, and you know, if you don't watch it, it can become a monoculture.
Right.
But if you have, I think that's one of the premises. I believe, and I could be wrong, about burning meadows, because some plants can become aggressive, and a prescribed burn can come in and take them out. So it helps mitigate and balance when the goldenrod's gotten a little bit too much, or you know.
So your garden is for the most part a perennial garden.
Yes, but I have several really important annuals that are native and biennials that are native. And most people think that, you know, what? We have annual natives. Well, when I moved into the garden, I found this absolutely stunning little plant in the backyard that is called Entire Leaf Western Daisy. And
say it again.
Entire Leaf Western Daisy. Okay. Just look up Western Daisy.
Okay.
And I can't pronounce the name right now. I can't remember it.
Okay,
but it is an annual. And winter annuals, what they do is they set their seed in the summer after they've been fertilized and go to seed. And in the fall, it begins to germinate.
Okay.
And then in the spring, it just goes kapow. And then it blooms. It's a very short year-long life cycle, and the seeds, it makes seeds and keeps going, and it is really beautiful, and it is a lovely ground cover.
So you collect the seeds?
No, I actually moved the transplant of the plants where I wanted them, and I just let them go.
Okay.
So
they just reseed themselves.
I will tell you my, and the other one that's absolutely gorgeous are blue-eyed Marys.
Okay.
They are just beautiful plants, but in the way that got started in my garden is that I sent for seeds that someone collected, and the woman who collected the seeds no longer has a garden center, and I planted them, and in order for me to make sure I have them is I sometimes put a pot underneath the plant right before the flowering season is over to collect any fallen seeds.
Okay.
And then I watch, and if I see seedlings, then I move it around. That way I can ensure that I have seeds of these plants of these very delicate plants.
Okay.
Because the leaves that fall in the garden are heavy.
Sure. And you wouldn't otherwise.
Yeah.
Yeah. We had some blue-eyed Mary, and I think we've lost it. We have a problem weed, which is a nutgrass.
Oh, yeah.
And the stems of that nutgrass look very similar to the stems of the blue-eyed Mary. And I think that in our weeding that we just lost it.
Yeah.
So I may try blue-eyed Mary again. So
Collinsia Verna.
Okay.
I think that's small,
6-inch at the...
Yeah, it's a little tiny blue and white. The flowers are just this lovely sky blue and cloud white, and they're sweet as can be. And they like moisture, which is really funny because I don't have a moist garden. But I plant it where I can keep an eye on it and make sure it gets a little bit of moisture. If you go to my blog and look up Blue-Eyed Mary, you can see a picture of what the first leaves look like. It will help you.
The first true leaf from germination,
what it looks like, and then you can keep an eye because they might still be there. These seeds, I think, when you think about wildflower seeds, their seeds are viable for
several years.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah,
and
so
all of our gardens have seed beds. I mean, that's why they don't encourage people to get in there and till the soil anymore, because that just like brings up all these weeds.
Well, this is a story on myself, and we were walking around my yard before we just started talking today, and I told you about Bermuda grass eradication in the area that we try to grow a turf grass. The Bermuda grass is so invasive, and it gets into the garden in such difficulty. It's a mess. And I don't want to use Roundup or chemicals. I've done it and will still do it, but I don't like to do it.
Yeah.
But in the process of trying to establish some turf grass there. I tilled a little bit with a little Mantis tiller.
Is this one of the grasses that grows from every little leaf node?
Well, and what I've gotten is a stand of Creeping Charlie.
I actually like Creeping Charlie.
Well, I don't.
I know. Really.
It's a childhood thing. It's everywhere.
Oh, yeah. I have it, too. It's pretty bad.
So, which illustrates your point that we have seeds dormant in the soil everywhere.
Right.
Of all kinds. Yeah. So,
Have you seen that verbascum that looks like, I mean, you see it in the fields when you're driving down the road. It has these big leaves that look like lamb's ear leaves.
Okay.
Have you seen them in the
No.
field? Well, it's a plant that, this is when I realized how you have to be really careful with invasives. It's considered an invasive.
Okay.
And it makes over 100,000 seeds.
Oh, gee.
And they live forever in your soil. And so when you turn that soil over, they go, oh, thank you. Here's the sun. Oh, here's some more rain. I will grow. So that's why I'm really careful about planting things in the garden that I know are just obnoxious.
Tilling.
I have a Mantis tiller that's in the shed someplace that I used back when I was trying all those different, I think earlier when we were talking, I told you that I started out on trying to do all kinds of other gardens, and I planted daylilies and I tilled.
Right.
You know, so, but I haven't used it for 25 years.
Other than this little experiment with this lawn, I don't use my tiller hardly ever anymore, even in my vegetable garden.
I don't think we really need to till in a wildflower garden. The thing about wildflowers is that most of them really like, unless you look at the cultural conditions that they want, it says deep, rich soil. A lot of them really want lean, rough soil. I mean, they just don't want perfection because they haven't had it. I mean, take for instance the Tennessee coneflower. Are you familiar with that? Well, we're here in Nashville. We're growing in the what's called the Nashville Basin, or the Central Basin. Central Basin.
Yeah, sometimes on the Highland Rim, in the edge of town.
But and that's where you get the really shallow soil, and you've got plants that are just like growing practically out of rock. And so if you took that plant, which you now can get, called Rocky Top, in a garden center, and put it in your rich garden soil that you've been growing vegetables in, and you decided you wanted to add some more wildflowers to, it would just flop and be really unhappy because it wants some really lean, dry, full sun, baking, in the summer soil. And that, a plant's cultural conditions are really important to know. And the only way to know that is to just research plants. And I'm going to make a recommendation. I signed up to get the Cultural Conditions Planting Book from Prairie Moon Garden because it is rich with information about what plants need.
Right.
Now, again, there's from, Michigan or Wisconsin or someplace like that, but it still knows and educated me about what plants really need. And that's important.
I think nature study is really a key for a gardener, particularly one that's trying to do native plants. The going out and seeing where things occur naturally.
Right.
For instance, blueberries. Now, when we started our native garden, we got 3 or 4 blueberry bushes, which we have one remaining. Because we don't have the condition here for blueberries.
No, they like really acid soil, which means that it's something with sour soil. It's just really...
The last time I saw blueberries occur in nature was up on the top of a bald in the Smokies where the soils are as thin as they could possibly be and the conditions are really rough in terms of sun exposure and cold and there's a couple bluffs around Fall Creek Falls where they grow.
And they're so happy and they're so big. They're 10 foot tall.
They love it there.
But you know what? That brings up something that you can actually do. you can do a couple of things if you want these plants and you're willing to nurture them or baby them. And what I do is I plant in containers.
Okay.
Because I have the kind of soil that stays wet in the winter.
Okay.
And plants that really like sharp drainage, like Agastaches, and other plants, some salvias, really like sharp drainage, which means they don't want to have wet feet. Doesn't mean they want to be dry, but it means that when it rains, they want the water to rush through.
Right.
I plant them in containers that I have mixed a lot of shale. I buy a product that's expanded shale, and it helps the water drain through really fast. And it's the way that I can add more plants and bring more plants that pollinators like into my garden.
So that would keep the roots from being damaged by the freeze and thaw? Is that what's going on there?
No, it keeps the roots from rotting in the winter.
Oh, rotting in the winter.
Because they rot.
Okay.
It's like if you planted lavender in our soil.
Right. Well, I've tried.
It rots. It rots because it needs, it's a Mediterranean plant,
right,
and it really wants it to be dry.
Right.
And the humidity in the summer is a bit much. But it can survive with some baby. And so you can plant those plants in containers and they'll do okay.
Okay.
And so I plant things. If something needs a deeper soil and a lot of moisture, I can't grow swamp milkweed.
Okay.
Which is Asclepias incarnata. It's a beautiful pink flowering milkweed that a monarch butterflies like to lay their eggs on, but I can't grow it. I don't have the moisture. I don't have the depth of soil to keep it moist, so I will plant it in a container. But I don't have that problem at all with the beautiful orange butterfly plant, which is Asclepias tuberosa, but it's
the
one you see all the time.
That's the one you see all the time.
Yeah. Plant it in some ugly soil with no rain, and it's happy.
It will do great.
So that those knowing a plant's cultural conditions really make a big difference. You know, you mentioned earlier about buying a big flat of blue stem. And one of the things that I've done with lawn is that I have a native plant lawn.
Okay.
And it's naturally occurring in my garden. It's called poverty grass.
You gave me some poverty grass, and it's doing wonderfully. But I never thought that it would stand up to a
It mower. Will not stand up to a lot of walking.
Or walking. Okay.
No, it won't. But and it doesn't like competition.
Right.
So you have to put it someplace that you just want it to be. And I have a couple spots for that.
Okay.
But what you can do is that you could actually plant little blue stem. You could plant big blue stem. You can plant even switchgrass. And if you plant them dense enough, they can make a beautiful lawn, and can be mowed.
Okay. Wow. I didn't know that, and I've not seen any resources.
You don't see that here much, but
there
was a big grass movement on the East Coast, and I can't remember the name of it. It was something about, you know, keeping, you know, the whole. It was something with lawn in it, and it was really clever. And I ordered a book from the Brooklyn Botanical Center, and it was about native plants. And one of them was an article about how you could have native grass, you know, as a lawn alternative. And I thought it was really wonderful. The problem for me is that where I wanted it, I don't have enough sun. So you have to have
full sun
for these native grasses.
Because these are
prairie grasses.
Yes, and they left to their own, they'll grow tall.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, little blue stem won't grow as tall as, but you know, I mean, if you want a lawn and you live in a neighborhood and they don't want you to have, six-foot grasses in your yard, you could actually put some grasses in that could be mowed and they're native and they don't take. They don't need fertilizers, and they don't need all these chemicals, and you don't need,
to be de-weeding
them.
Right.
I mean, you know.
You'd have to, if you wanted to do that with little blue stem, you'd have to buy a lot of little blue stem.
Or
get some seed.
Or you'd have to do seed.
Yeah.
And then you'd have to do what they recommend, which is And they actually recommend killing what's there.
Right.
And they actually recommend doing it with Roundup, which is what, you know, I don't use because I don't trust myself handling it.
We were recently in East Tennessee at the new state park called the Seven Islands State Birding Park.
I don't know that park.
It's just to the east of Knoxville, just on the edge of Knox County, along the French Broad River.
Well, that's pretty over there.
It's beautiful, and they have several hundred acres that used to be a dairy farm. And the dairy farm...
Well, there's a rich soil there.
It's right along the river, and the dairy farm to provide grazing for the cattle had a particular type of non-native grass that they were growing. And in the process of changing the ecology of this place back to a more natural condition.
Right, and repairing, the creek.
They went through there with boom-mounted sprayers and just killed the heck out of all that old grass with Roundup and all kinds of stuff. But they have beautiful tall grasses there now, and they're starting to get the bobwhite quail back in.
Oh, that's so beautiful.
And
right.
But it sometimes comes to resorting to the chemicals.
You know, and one of my big objections to all of the poisons and the insecticides and the pesticides that are out there is that I don't really believe that they should be sold to me or people like me because I'm not trained to handle them. I think people make the mistake of thinking because they're sold in a store that they're safe to use. And I know people that don't pay attention to the instructions that talk about this, wear gloves, do this, do that, wear a mask, don't spray when the wind is blowing. And it's just, I just think it's unregulated and we don't need those kind of unregulated poisons out there.
Let's not be so serious.
Okay.
So here we are in the beginning of February.
Oh, I'm itching to get to the planting.
Well, and so what are you thinking about, and what are you doing right now?
Right now, I have some guys in my yard who are arborists, who are taking down dead limbs and taking care of my trees.
Okay.
They may open the canopy up just a little bit. Okay. I'm not sure, so that I can have a little bit more sun. One of the things that happens in a garden like mine or any yard with trees is they grow, and your gardens get shadier. And before you know it, the garden that once was isn't. And that's part of what's happened to my garden. So I'm trying to... What I'm thinking about is when I'm going to go out there and cut back the grasses.
Okay.
And when I'm going to go out and cut back. Because I don't do what's traditionally called a fall cleanup. I leave everything standing. And the reason I leave it standing is that critters hide in the grasses and for protection. Birds do. And also, native bees nest in some of the hollow stems of a lot of the native wildflowers. So when I cut them back, I may leave them standing about 12 inches. So they're still, I mean, people are going to say that's really ugly. My ideas of beauty have changed since I've become a wildflower gardener. And 12 inches of standing stems in my garden is not going to bother me because in 2 months it'll be covered up with something else.
You know,
but that still allows bees to still continue.
I have a couple stands of the switchgrass, which is the autumn wind or something like that. Switchgrass. Anyway.
Northwind. It's a tall,
and it's 6 foot tall. And we leave it stand through the wintertime.
It's beautiful,
isn't it? It's quite beautiful and adds a little interest. And I will not cut it back until I actually see a little bit of new growth.
When I cut it back. And it's a really sad day when I do that. Because what that means is, because grasses do, these are warm season grasses.
Right.
And they take a while before they green up. So there'll be this little stubby spot there for a while that I'll miss that.
Right. You give them a haircut.
Yeah, just to give them a haircut. But what I'm beginning to look for now are the native ephemerals.
Okay.
Right now, the toothworts are coming out. And there's one that has already sent its leaves up, and it's late February, if it warms up a bit, they'll be blooming.
So the ephemerals are native wildflowers that, because as the word implies, don't last very long. They quickly come and go.
Well, what they do is they're really dependent upon the canopies, the deciduous canopy. So they get all of their the sun kind of shine that they need in the winter. Okay. It, you know, warms the earth. They come up before the trees leaf out. They sprout, they grow, their leaves come out, and they collect all of the goodness that they get from the sun before the trees fill out. And then
before the leaves make that canopy.
Yes. And right. then they're, if they're fortunate, they get pollinated, they set seed, and they disappear. And some take a little bit longer than others to disappear. And so some have really dramatic seed heads that are fabulous.
So we have trout lily, we have a whole bunch of things like that.
Jack of the pulpit.
And the cup bump of the
springtime. Green dragon,
And you have those in your garden.
I have green dragon that naturally occurs. It's the cousin of a jack of the pulpit. Okay. So it has the three leaves, and I have naturally occurring trillium in my garden. Okay. And I have added a one that's native to Tennessee. It's called it's a really beautiful lutium. It's a yellow flowered one. And I have to protect them.
Okay.
Because one of the things that happens when you let leaves fall on the ground is mice and voles use the leaves as a wonderful winter cover and tunnel. And so they have always been in our gardens and our woodlands, and they have always relied on these plants, and they eat the tubers. And so I lose some.
So are you at this time of the year getting garden catalogs and seed catalogs and that sort of stuff? And
I've already ordered plants.
So what's on your list this spring?
What's on my list this spring? I need to get in the garden and see what's still. It was a weird, unusual winter. It's been really dry. We're right now still in a little bit of a drought.
Okay.
And I've got to see what survived and what's going to happen when the canopies open a little bit. But my eyes are always bigger than my garden's capable of handling.
Okay.
What did I order? I ordered a couple of unusual... what are they? Milkweeds.
Oh, okay.
That I'm going to have to grow in a container close to the hose, right by
because
the front door.
Because it needs
to be wet.
Okay.
So that's what I'll do.
And your purpose in that is to attract the butterflies?
Yeah. We're not on what's known as the monarch trail, but we do get monarchs, and I do like to support them. But other parts of the country, the monarchs, when they're going to and from Mexico, fly over. Eastern Tennessee and North Carolina are on the Monarch Trail. On to the west of us, over parts of Kansas and Nebraska, are on the Monarch Trail, which is why there's a big movement out there to restore the habitat for monarchs. But I just do it because I love them, and because I'm taking this as a challenge.
I love it. So as we were walking around my garden earlier today, you asked me about what my favorites were, and I told you they were the native azaleas.
They really are beautiful.
And let me return the question. What are your favorites out in your garden?
Oh my gosh, you're asking me to choose my favorite child. I don't know. At each season I have a different favorite. And so what's going to come up almost in March is... something called Phacelia, which is another name for it is scorpion weed, and it's this biennial. We also have biennial natives, and it is absolutely stunning purple flower in the watermark family, and Hydrophylla, I think, is the family, and it is just beautiful. And the earliest bees will be out visiting it, and so I'm really crazy in love with them.
But say the name of that again.
It's Phacelia.
Phacelia.
PH.
Okay.
Phacelia.
All right.
But honestly, when I first started blogging, the plant that my garden was known for was Phlox pilosa.
Okay.
And it was called...
Which was what your site, your blog picture today.
Yes, it is, that's what the blog is all about. It's practically perfect pink phlox is what I started calling it. And I have sent that plant to people all over. They just absolutely love it. Wherever it is native, I have sent it. But this is, it's a really beautiful phlox that naturalizes, and it's stunning.
Now this is, we refer to this as garden phlox, which is a taller phlox.
That is paniculata.
Okay.
That is phlox paniculata.
Okay.
And this is pilosa,
okay.
Which I can't exactly recall what it means, but I think it actually has something to do with like little hairs and things all over it.
All right.
So you'll see the first photo on my blog post today. Okay. You'll look at it, you'll think, you'll see all the little hairs on that plant. And that,
how tall does that plant get? So 18 inches.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So, and it's a ground cover, and it's just stunning, and I love it, and it smells wonderful.
Yeah.
So it is
yeah.
truly a plant that's identified with me. But and it's not quite a rough and tumble plant, but what those plants that are really, but I do love the native asters. They in the fall, they make my heart just feel good because the bees, who I'm just crazy about, are all over them. And that's, and I have as many different ones as I can possibly support that are native to Davidson County and the Central Basin.
All right. And there's one of those, as my recollection is, there's one of those that's actually fragrant.
I don't have that one.
No.
I must search it out.
Okay, well, I'll have to get back to you on that one.
Yeah.
I listened to a blog, or not a blog, a podcast called the Native Plant Podcast.
I know them.
Yeah. We both know
those
people.
Yeah, I know Mike, and I've met John.
Yeah, I've not met John. But those guys have an encyclopedic knowledge of what's out there.
I know,
That I'm envious of, but...
They pronounce it all correctly, too.
They were talking about this aromatic aster.
Aromatic aster?
Yeah. And I can't remember, but it seemed like it was native to the
upper
Cumberland region or
wow.
something like that.
I'll have to think about that and check
yeah.
it out. I'll check and see if they have it on their website
yeah.
and they sell it.
Yeah. So.
Yeah. Now, the thing I like about Grow Wild, or Mike, who you're just talking right. about, they have, a lot of their plants are from the Central Basin,
right.
but they're not afraid to try plants that might be from West Tennessee or, you know, East Tennessee, because we do have a lot of different growing conditions around
here. And they're changing
here.
Too, aren't they?
Yeah, they are changing.
Yeah.
It's getting warmer
right.
and different. So, they are my go-to to garden people. In fact, I probably need to go out there really soon because I need a garden fix.
Well, they'll be having their spring sale here in the next month or so.
In April. Sometime in
yeah.
April, but I don't know the date.
Yeah. So, well, listen, you've been wonderful to come by and talk. We could probably make another show of it sometime. Just talking.
I'm so surprised I had so much to say.
Talking about all these favorite plants. But folks, please do check out the blog called Clay and Limestone with my friend, Gail Eichelberger. Thank you, Gail.
Oh, thank you, Mark. It's really been a lot of fun.
All right.